From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Voter registration and early voting are record-breaking this year. California says 19.6 million voters are registered. Nevada reports 1.5 million. So let's say Texas is reporting early voting records. Add Florida, Wisconsin, and Ohio to the list. Minnesota and Iowa are on track for the same number. The list of states is long. Tomorrow, of course, is midterm election day across the United States. Cap Radio and NPR will begin live coverage at 5 o'clock, and the political junkie Ken Rudin will join us from the Washington, D.C. area. Of course, it's Monday, so we're going to start this hour in a conversation with Ken, our regular weekly chat. Hi, Ken.
This is my favorite time of year, Beth. Hi, Beth.
I know. This is your Super Bowl, but let me start with this. When has a midterm election been as consequential as this one could be?
Well, that's a good question because, you know, every time is a midterm election, we always say, oh, this is the most consequential in history.
Right.
And, you know, often we do say that. In 2006, during 6 years after George W. Bush, the midterm elections were very important about the conduct of the war in Iraq and the response to Katrina and rising prices. In 2010, Barack Obama's first midterm election, it was consequential because of, you know, it was going to be a verdict on Obama, whose numbers were not good, and Obamacare, which was still in its early stages. So all those things, all those previous midterm elections were very consequential. Having said that, this is a big one because, you know, you have a president whose numbers are hovering around 40-45%, which is not too dissimilar to what it was with Barack Obama in 2010. But the difference is that there's a toxicity in this election, in the rhetoric and the kind of rallies you hear around the country that are frightening people. There are questions about the future of women's reproductive rights and immigration reform and things like that. So is it consequential? It absolutely is. It is the most ever. We like to think it is. It certainly is very consequential, and it certainly could give us a signal of what it's going to be like for the next 2 years of the Trump term.
But Ken, the dramatic difference is early voting and these record high numbers of people registering. The mystery, though, is which party is so motivated? And are these young voters, are they unlikely voters? Are they non-white voters? Who is making up all these numbers across the country?
These are great, great and important questions because every year, every cycle, and we can go back, you know, to decades, we always talk about the youth vote and will the youth come out and vote? And even when they lowered the voting age in 1971 and when Nixon and McGovern were running in 72, everybody said, let's watch the youth vote. And every time that doesn't seem to be the case. This time, especially in the aftermath of the horrific killings in Parkland, Florida, in the school shootings, we've heard more and more young people saying, this time, we're not going to leave it up to the so-called adults. We're going to take elections in our own hands, and we're going to vote. And at least anecdotal evidence, if you look at the lines around the country, which are sometimes enormous, hours long, in early voting, there seems to be an enthusiasm that we haven't seen in a long, long time. Now, I will say that in the aftermath of the Kavanaugh Supreme Court nomination, Republican enthusiasm has increased as well. For a long time, we were talking about the Democratic blue wave. Republicans are saying, wait a second, we vote too, and we're angry too, and we have something to say as well. So right now, I think there's a little more of an enthusiasm advantage for the Democrats, but that gap is shrinking, and my goodness, it's going to be so many close races that, again, with a day to go, we still have no idea who's going to win.
I'm so curious about which way the women's vote goes in this country, too. And you're right, heavy turnout typically favors Democrats, but this seems to be such a different era. And I think the reason that we're all wondering what's going to happen is that the polls went in such a different direction by a majority in the 2016 elections that polls almost seem a factor to look at, but less predictive than they ever were before.
I agree completely, because the one thing polls do not show, it does not show enthusiasm. It does not show turnout. Mm-hmm. There is, you know, there's regular voters and there's likely voters. But there's also something called certain voters, and we don't know if they're certain voters until they show up to vote. So, yes, you know, look, on the day of the election, and, you know, Beth, we've been talking about this for at least 2 years, for the day of the election, 2016, I couldn't see a path for Donald Trump to win the presidency. Did not see him winning Pennsylvania, Ohio, well, maybe Ohio, but certainly not Michigan and Wisconsin. And there with the ball game right there. So, of course, the difference, of course, is this is not a national election. These are 35 individual races for the Senate, 36 individual races for governor, all 435 House seats. And you know, what could be a big red wave in states like North Dakota, for example, may not be the same case in states like California. So, you know, everybody, and that's what's fascinating about tomorrow night. You know, there are different time zones where we can see indications of what might happen. The fact that Indiana closes at 6 p.m. Eastern, we may know if Democrat Senator Joe Donnelly gets defeated. But later in the evening, with Arizona and California and Nevada and states like that, there could be other, you know, changes to the blue side. So it's going to be a long night and an exciting night.
So, of course, there are a lot of key local issues. I want to sum up what we're going to be watching very closely out here in the West in terms of national races. The Democrats need to flip 23 seats to take control of the House, and California has a number of those, and we're the latest in terms of the polling out here. So it could be 5 seats, it could be 7 that make the decision. So that's key for the House. Looking at the Senate, perhaps the most vulnerable seat in the country is just across the border in Nevada. So there's a race there that the whole country is going to be watching.
Certainly the one in Nevada is the most vulnerable Republican. Most vulnerable senator is Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, a Democrat seeking a second term. I think she goes down to defeat, but with Dean Heller in Nevada, first of all, he barely won in 2012. He's the only Republican senator running in a state that was won by Hillary Clinton. The polls show it dead even, or maybe Heller with a point or two over Democratic Congresswoman Jackie Rosen. So, boy, that is going to be a close race, a large Latino constituency that could affect the ballgame, too. And Heller is not the darling of every Republican. Remember, for the longest time, he was very wary, if not opposed to Donald Trump as a candidate and President Trump as a president. And then when conservatives started talking about mounting a conservative challenge to Heller in the primary, he moved closer and closer to Trump. So Heller has it's a tough tightrope for him to walk. He can't go too far right, or he'll alienate all the Democrats there. He can't go too far left, or the conservatives will sit home. I don't envy Dean Heller tomorrow, even if he does win.
Nevada has an important governor's race, too, and that brings up the point that President Trump and former President Barack Obama were stumping this weekend and paying a lot of time and energy and focus in some of the governor's races.
You know something, we always focus on, we've been focusing on the battle for the House. The Democrats need 23 seats. We've been focusing on the battle for the Senate. Right now it's only 51-49 Republican, and we should be focusing on that. But we forget that in the gubernatorial races around the country, the 36 of them, first of all, of the 36 that are up, 26 are now held by Republicans, only 9 by Democrats, which gives the Democrats more targets and more opportunities to win. Plus the fact that we forget that it's the governors around the country, as well as the state legislatures, that will decide they will draw the congressional districts after the 2020 census. So for all we talk about, oh, everything is gerrymandered and my vote doesn't count because of redistricting and partisan gerrymandering, the gubernatorial races around the country are crucial. For example, if Democrats do pickups in those races around the country, they could win Wisconsin, they'll probably win Illinois, they'll probably win Michigan, other states as well. They could win Georgia, which is a very closely watched race. Florida, they could win. That could change the drawings of the congressional district lines after 2020.
Let me back up a minute to the battle for the House, because Kevin McCarthy, Nancy Pelosi, Whichever way the party shift or doesn't shift happens in the House plays big in terms of California leadership in Congress. And I think it's worth saying something about that because that's pivotal. Nancy Pelosi is not guaranteed, if the House Democrats win, that she will return to being Speaker of the House.
That's a very important point. I mean, she's been the Democratic leader in the House for the longest time. She became Speaker after the Democrats won the House in 2006. But there are more and more Democratic candidates around the country, especially in kind of purplish districts and even red districts, where the Democratic candidates are saying, under no circumstances will I be voting for Nancy Pelosi for Speaker because, you know, we need new leadership. She's 78 years old, and I don't want to play the age issue, but you know, there are a lot of young Democrats out there chomping at the bit and, you know, hoping for a new kind of younger leadership. So she's not guaranteed. And I just wonder about Kevin McCarthy, too. He's the likely front runner if the Republicans win that control the House, or even if they're in the minority, he could be the minority leader. But again, you know, that unbelievable tweet he sent out last week about, you know, whether Steyer, Bloomberg, and Soros are going to buy the election, which many people around the country took as a dog whistle for anti-Semitism. That hurt McCarthy. I don't know if that's going to hurt his chances of leading the Republicans, but I would say that no matter what happens on Tuesday in the battle for the House, neither Nancy Pelosi nor Kevin McCarthy is guaranteed of being the leader of their party.
Nate Silver on his 538 political website is giving a 4 in 5 chance, 81%, that the Democrats win control of the House, just a 1 in 5, 19% that the Republicans do. But his quote over the weekend, Ken, was that there is a wide range of outcomes in the House, that it's really wide. And that speaks statistically to how many variations there are in the scenario tomorrow on Election Day.
Well, that's why my answer is always going to be, don't pay attention to Nate Silver. Don't pay attention to Ken Rudin. Don't pay attention to those who saying this will happen or that will happen. Just vote.
Just make sure
you vote. Don't do what a lot of people did in 2016, that they whined and moaned about the result. And they said, oh, did you vote? And they said, no. So you got to go out and vote. But regarding the battle for the House, you can't overemphasize the importance of California in this, because there, as you said earlier in the show, there are at least 5, 6, or 7 House seats that are at the worst dead even. These are Republican House seats that are at the worst dead even, and the best scenario for the Democrats, they could pick up 1 or 2. Right now, I think they're guaranteed to pick up the Darrell Issa's seat, the 49th district in Southern California. But there are at least 5 or 6 other Republican seats that the Republicans are no better than even in that. And again, if the Democrats are going to get their 23 seats to put them in the majority, one place to look is California. And as you said, pointed out earlier, it'll be a late night because California, we don't know until 11 o'clock Eastern what's going to happen there. And then we first have to first start counting. There are no exit polls in House races. So we may be up all night Tuesday night to see who wins control of the House.
Well, out here we do have good weather. It's going to be dark earlier in the evening because of our time change, but weather can be a factor. You know, Ken, often in our conversations we spend time on the president and his choices, and I don't want to do that today. I just want to leave the point with go vote, go cast your ballot. However you do it, wherever you do it, make sure your vote happens and that it can count.
And especially be aware of the efforts around the country to either curtail the vote or intimidate people not to vote or outright voter suppression. It's a sacred right that we have. Take advantage of it. You got to vote. And it doesn't matter if you vote Democratic, Republican, third party, you know, the United Martian Party. It doesn't really matter. Just make sure you vote on Tuesday. And then we'll see what happens. And then we'll start this process all over again for 2020, which you know will begin on Wednesday morning.
You will be here with us for the play-by-play tomorrow night, by phone anyway, not in person. We will look forward.
I want to be there in person.
2020, we'll make that happen.
I'll start driving now.
All right. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Beth. Have a good night tomorrow.
Ken Rudin is the political junkie, and our election coverage tomorrow night, which includes Ken among our analysts, starts at 5 p.m. live results and analysis and online blogging. You can find it all at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.